Welcome back to another episode of the Huxley Morton podcast, where this week I am joined by Paul Fenton. Paul is the CEO at Montrium. Paul, welcome to the show. Good morning for yourself, I believe, over in Canada, is it?
It's actually lunchtime, but yeah.
Oh, have we just tipped over, I believe, perhaps.
We've just tipped over, but yeah, very nice to see you, James. Thanks for inviting me on.
You are very much welcome. Well, look, Paul, I've given you a quick intro there, but for those who have been in the clinical research world and perhaps living in the dark and don't know what Montrium is or haven't heard the company name, give us a quick intro as to your role and the company and what you do. Sure. As a business, I guess.
So my role in the company, I'm the CEO of the company, so I'm the person that kind of kicked it off, founded it, mm-hmm. Was it 17 years ago? And my role is obviously to provide executive leadership, but also to provide insight into what I think we should be providing as a product and service to our clients.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of that product and service, so what is it that we do? So we're basically a software as a service company. So we provide a platform that really focuses on helping our clients tell a better story of what happened in their clinical trials.
Okay.
And this is kind of important because obviously our clients are looking to get approvals for new drugs that they're developing. And so our system, which is essentially an electronic trial master file, allows them to organize all of the information that they're collecting, all of the evidence that they're generating in the execution of the clinical trial, and then present that in a coherent way to tell an accurate story of the trial to a regulatory inspector who's evaluating them and evaluating their dossier for their new drug approval.
Very, very interesting. Now, I'd like to get into the story side of things and what type of stories they're trying to portray in order to get approval. But you mentioned that, you know, you were the man behind the business 17 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, for many people, I guess, kind of the rise of clinical research and clinical trials and that awareness has perhaps come around in recent years with COVID. You know, we're going back 17 years. I mean, how did you first get into this space, into this field? And
right.
Just, you know, where did the idea from the business come from? And what were you doing prior to that?
Yeah. So maybe I'll answer the second part of the question first. Mm-hmm. So what was I doing prior? So as you can tell from my accent, I'm not originally from Canada. I'm actually from the UK. And after I finished university, I was actually working for the Eurostar project, which was the high-speed train between London, Paris, and Brussels. And my job there was to work in logistics, making sure that we had everything we needed for the trains as they were leaving either Paris, London, or Brussels. And when I came into that job, fresh out of university and very keen, I saw that the systems that were being used were actually pretty poor. And it was really difficult to kind of do all of the forecasting and all of the other logistical work that was required. And so I started to kind of build out my own tools, if you like.
Right.
And the guys that I was working with in the headquarters in Brussels, they were sort of, providing all of the systems. And they realized that, I was actually building these things that could be useful for the organization as a whole. And so they decided to move me over to Brussels to the coordination center. And that's really when I started to get into the whole business of developing applications to solve logistical problems. And clinical trials are kind of logistical problems, if you like.
Yeah. What was it you were doing at university then? Because as you say, like, you're kind of fresh out of university. Yeah. And then you're building stuff up. I'm assuming that all of the companies that were, working on this big project are fairly sizable construction and engineering companies. You know, they're not hiring people who aren't already skilled. So,
right.
Is it about what you knew that allowed you to get into
my university background was more sort of in management and technology.
Mm.
And it's, you're right that, the railways are pretty big organizations, but I was working for a subcontractor at the railway, and it wasn't that big, and in fact, they weren't that advanced. Because, you know, this was like the 1990s, right? So technology wasn't what it is today.
Yeah.
So it was really just using tools that were available to come up with a better solution. But that kind of then, you know, that's what got me to Brussels, which is where I started my career in clinical trials. And that's also where I met somebody who actually said to me, hey, I'm going to work in the CRO. Do you want to join me? And so at that point, I was like, okay, yeah, why not? I mean, it's an interesting area. And so I went to work for a CRO where I was focusing a lot on data management applications, in randomization, drug supply management, all of those kinds of things. And the CRO was specialized in oncology trials. So that's really where I sort of started to learn my trade in the clinical trial world. And I remember one of my first ever projects was in Paris, one of the large pharmaceutical companies there, where they had their oncology affiliate who had just got approval for a new drug, a new chemotherapy drug in the US, and they were expecting approval in Europe. And they were looking to put in place a set of tools which would allow them to better manage all of the follow-up studies that they had to do, so all of the phase four studies in all of the various different affiliates that they had across the world. And so this project was called the Clinical Trial Toolkit. And it was a web-based platform where we would basically have clinicians enter a whole bunch of information about a clinical study. So these were quite often, you know, going to be investigator-initiated trials or sort of local trials in the different affiliates. So they would enter all of the parameters for the study. And basically, we would spit out a protocol that was like 90% complete. We would generate standard CRF pages, and we even wanted to go further and start to provide standard like SAS programs to do all of the analysis. And so it was a group of about 25 people from all different areas of clinical research. So there were there were biostatisticians, data managers, medical writers, clinicians. And so for me, my first ever project was really rich because I was exposed to all of these people that were involved in all aspects of clinical trials. And so I spent 5 years working on that project and within this CRO, and that was really my schooling, if you like.
Your specific role was, or like job title?
So I was actually running the department. So I was director of product. So this CRO had actually developed their own sort of data management products and randomization products, and they'd taken on this project as kind of like an ad hoc project.
Yeah.
But my team were basically developers or database administrators. And my role was really more of an analyst kind of role, coming up with the solution to their problem by sort of understanding that problem and then defining requirements so that we could then go and develop something. And it was actually quite successful. Like they launched it, and we were able to generate the protocols, and it really helped in standardizing as well all of the various different phase four studies that were done, so that they could even do things like pooled analysis, which was kind of interesting. And it was, for me, it was really an eye opener to be able to do something like that, because it also allowed me to understand all of the various different aspects and complications that we come up against with clinical trials, and also think about, well, how could we improve this with systems, which was kind of what I was doing with the railways. You know, it's a similar kind of situation that I found myself in, and that's really when I sort of decided to start up my own company to address the issue that we had around TMF, because at the time TMF was all paper. It was really, really laborious and challenging to be able to understand, well, do we have all of the information that we need to tell an accurate story? Is it of sufficient quality? Am I missing stuff? It's really critical, because obviously if you are missing information, or if you're not able to tell the story, all of a sudden you start getting observations during your inspections, and that delays or could even compromise your clinical program. So it's a really sort of mission critical thing for a lot of the pharma companies. And so I took it on as my mission to try and solve that problem. And we haven't solved it yet. The industry hasn't solved it yet, but we're getting there.
Sure. What do you think was it that made you want to take that on? Was it, is it anything to do with, I guess, your own frustration at the inefficiencies of it or something else?
I wouldn't say I was frustrated. I just like a challenge, and I'm actually very motivated by solving this kind of problem. And leveraging technology to do it, because I think that technology can solve these problems.
Yeah.
So it was more the challenge that motivated me. And even today, I mean, I'm still fighting for this future state where we have much better interoperability between systems. You know, the whole thing is very digital. In terms of all of the information that we're generating in clinical trials, and we're able to actually sort of tap into the information that we have and create even more knowledge and really accelerate things.
Yeah.
So there's still a lot of challenges out there that I'm definitely very motivated about, you know, solving those challenges or meeting those challenges.
Interesting. Where do you think that, I'm just, curious as to where that general motivation comes from, Paul, because I tend to find, certainly in my line of work, that people take action more so to get away from a problem than they do to achieve a goal, if that makes sense. Whereas it seems that you're saying the opposite. You quite like, you relish that challenge of trying to push forward. I mean, that's what I'm trying to get under your skin and try.
So I think it's because from. I also like to help people. I'm a very people focused person. And so I like nothing better, you know, sitting down with a sponsor, talking about their problems and then thinking about those problems and seeing if I can come up with a solution.
Sure.
So I think that the ultimate motivation is I'm just trying to help people that I appreciate in the industry who, and I know that they have this issue. I'm also sort of trying to, I don't like inefficiencies, and I think that we're very inefficient today in the way that we work. The way that we organize information, the way that we use systems, it's very kind of siloed and disconnected. And I think that we could just do it a lot better, you know. And the ultimate beneficiary of that is also going to be the patient, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're able to do things a lot better, you're able to sort of accelerate things, you're able to produce better quality, have better traceability, you can tell a better story, then we're going to get approvals for drugs more quickly as well, because it's just a lot easier as well for the regulators to be able to perform their evaluation. And, you know, you mentioned earlier COVID and the fact that COVID has changed things compared to 17 years ago. It has changed things because we've been able to demonstrate as an industry that we can do it a lot more efficiently. We can do it faster, and so can the regulators now. Obviously, with the, you know, COVID vaccines and the approvals that came out fairly quickly, there was a lot of caveats because, you know, there's a lot of follow-up that has to happen as well. And in general, you know, vaccine trials are fairly quick by nature. You know, they don't last for years, they last for months. So it's not, you know, we're not going to go completely to that model, but I definitely feel that we're going towards a more accelerated model. And I also feel that we're going towards a model where we're doing continuous evaluation.
Sure.
So in up until now, we've always done, you know, phase one, phase two, phase three studies, and then phase four once we get approval. What I'm starting to see now is where you have, you know, this one big study that's kind of a rollover. It just continues on and on and on right up until the end of phase three. And I think that will start to become the norm. And so it will also become natural for the regulators to want to evaluate in a continuous manner as well. And that's where having information that's well organized, that's connected, that's all digital and available to the regulator so that they can access it on an ongoing basis is going to become super important. And that's why we're seeing that there are so many initiatives out there right now around things like digital protocols or the Common Protocol Template or ICH-M11. We're also seeing the whole initiative around digital data flow, because the industry has recognized that it's really important that we actually start connecting these things together, because they know what's coming. Because the regulators are kind of pushing it. So that in itself is also something that I've always been fascinated in. How can we actually connect these things together to improve velocity, but also to improve quality and improve knowledge that we have, and really open up this goldmine of information that we have that today is not really used efficiently.
Sure. And it, I mean, do you remember the point? It sounds like, you know, in terms of the drive to help others tell their story and analyze and use this data and use this information, that's what's, you know, prompted the business. Do you remember the point where you decided that you were going to leave Brussels, when you were going to start the business? What was going through your head? You know, because I always just think, I mean, it's a big enough move, just moving like one country, you know, to go. Yeah. There's not many people I know that, you know, just jet off and are working in Brussels, but then to jet off somewhere else and start to a Canada business. Yeah. What was going on?
I don't know. I've always been, ever since I was a kid, we've always moved around a lot. So I've always been a bit of a nomad. I've lived in six different countries altogether.
Nice.
But when I was in Brussels, I was actually working a lot in Montreal, in Boston, in New York with sponsors, you know, through the CRO that I was employed by.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to change of scenery. And I thought that Montreal was kind of a cool place because, you know, it's like being in Europe in North America. So, you know, it's a French speaking city.
I was going to say, is it French speaking? So are you now?
Yeah, it's French speaking.
Picked up the lingo or?
Yeah, I could speak French before I arrived here. So I actually speak five languages, but French is my second language. But no, it made sense for me because it was closer to the US, but it wasn't the US. You know, I wanted to live in a more of a European city.
Yeah.
And Montreal is very similar to Brussels. In fact, it's kind of a melting pot of people from all over. Mm. And it's actually a really, you know, it's culturally interesting, and it's actually a really nice place to live as well. It's like a very green city. Mm. It's a bit cold, but you know, apart from that. Yeah, it's a really nice place. And so that was kind of my primary motivation. But at the same time, you know, the CRO that I was working with in Brussels said, well, we want you to continue on doing what you're doing because we, you know, we appreciate your work. So we want you to head up the office in Cambridge, Mass. So that's kind of what I did. You know, that sort of made the move over the Atlantic a lot easier because it was kind of a continuation. Mm-hmm. Of what I was doing in Belgium, but I'm glad I made the move. I've been here for 20 years now, so I'm enjoying it, and I think there's the Canadian dream, right? So everything is possible. Yeah, you just got to put your mind to it. So yeah,
fine. And look, when you moved over, had you already launched a company at that point, or
no? I was obviously I was managing the US affiliate of the CRO that I was working for in Belgium. But then another opportunity came up where I could work locally. And at that point, I kind of wanted to start to integrate into the local environment, you know, because I was working pretty much either with the team in Cambridge or the team in Brussels.
Yeah.
So I took the opportunity, and it was actually a pretty interesting role. It was, my job was to work for a project that was being funded by the Canadian Institute of Health Research by McGill University and the Quebec Ministry of Health.
Mm.
And the goal of this project was to improve the quality of epidemiology research being done in the province, because they were finding that, you know, they were funding a lot of epidemiology studies, but the data that was being produced was of poor quality. It was being collected in Excel spreadsheets and things like that. There wasn't really any sharing of data or standardization of data.
Right.
And there are also issues around sort of GCP and compliance and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had put in place this project to develop standards and to develop a platform to collect this data. So similar to an EDC type system.
Mm.
And then they had a whole army of data managers that they'd put in place to help these you know, primarily academic investigators improve the quality of their data.
Mm-hmm.
And my job was to come in, because obviously I was coming from a CRO that had a very strong data management group, and I'd worked a lot in data management applications, to come in and actually help them try and set up a public-private partnership, basically, where they would be able to offer their services to the industry as well. And they had like a whole network of investigators that were sort of actively working within this platform as well. And so it was kind of interesting for the industry. Unfortunately, it didn't really work out. There were for political reasons, it didn't really work out.
Right.
And so I had to shut it down, which was not an easy thing to do. And at that point, I was like, okay, I'm just going to become a consultant. I'm not going to manage people anymore. I'm just going to go and do my thing. I know enough people in Boston to be able to get, you know, some consulting gigs. And that's what I did. But that didn't last very long. I mean, it only lasted, I got my first contract pretty much straight away. But then, you know, within sort of 3 or 4 months, I already had too much work just for me. So I then hired a, you know, my first employee and then my second employee. And it sort of started like that. And so we became like this group of consultants, that, which then transformed into developing a piece of software, which we were providing on premise, which we then transformed again by providing it as a cloud-based solution. And that's kind of the way it went. And so that's what we've been doing for the past 15 years and or 17 years rather. And yeah, I mean, I love every minute of it. I mean, I wake up every day feeling energized and got a great group of people that I work with and some really interesting stuff like going on both within our organization, but also within the industry, because I'm also quite active with, you know, CDISC. I chair a working group that's developing TMF standards and things like that. So a lot going on.
Wow.
But really interesting stuff.
It sounds like it. So it started almost, as you say, like kind of yourself picking up work, having too much work, group of consultants.
Right.
I guess that's a fantastic problem to have as an independent consultant at that point.
Yeah.
What do you think that you were doing that some other independent consultants are, perhaps? Is it the product or was it you? I mean, because, you know, sometimes I work with people,
well, I mean,
sometimes the individual. I mean, feel free to blow your own trumpet a little bit, but
I don't blow my own trumpet, but I definitely I like interacting with people. I like, you know, as I said earlier, helping people, organizing people. And I think because of my experience in the past, where, you know, I was talking about the project in Paris where developing this toolkit, and I got a really good understanding of all of the different systems we use in clinical trials. I was very easily able to pick up projects for implementing various different systems like CTMS or EDC or, ECTD systems for regulatory submissions. So all of the various different systems I really understood. And then I also understood all of the processes, all of the clinical processes that we need to manage with these systems, because I also touched on all of those processes while I was at the CRO. And so I was able to kind of sit down with a clinical group and say, okay, guys, you know, let's look at where you're at. Let's look at where you're going in terms of your clinical development. And, you know, I was always working with sort of the smaller biotechs who are kind of starting up and didn't really have that much knowledge around the systems or even the processes sometimes. And so I would actually, you know, become part of their team and help them develop a plan and a roadmap in terms of what systems they needed and when did they need them. And then how did they want to use those systems? How did they want to adapt their processes with the systems to improve the processes and empower those processes with those systems? So I think that I had kind of a nice little like recipe, if you like, for helping biotechs kind of get off the ground and become digital and improve the way that they worked and improve the way they managed information. And there was a lot of appetite for that at the time, because this is, you know, it's like 2005 2006. A lot of stuff was still very manual. It was still very paper based, and so, you know, a lot of these biotechs were very dependent on, you know, venture cap funding. They wanted to be organized. They wanted to be able to show their investors that they were in control of their science, but they're also in control of, you know, their regulatory submissions and all of their documentation and their data. Because it was really important for, you know, even due diligence purposes, if they wanted to go out and get another round of funding, well, they had to demonstrate this, that they had good data, that they were in control of the science. And so all the things that I was doing was really sort of making them more organized so that they could, you know, demonstrate that to their investors as well. And so I think that's why there was also an appetite for what I was doing. And I was able to sort of rinse and repeat that pretty much. By sort of, you know, bringing in people that I knew So these were people that I'd worked with before, who I knew had sort of similar skill sets and could work with me to provide this solution. Sure. I think that's why it was successful.
Interesting. Well, I guess gives us a good insight as to how it looked in the early days. And, you know, if you can bring in people that you know, look, that's amazing. That's what we would all like to do for our businesses, right? But I know, you know, having looked at you on LinkedIn and the business now, it's a much larger organization.
Right.
How did you manage that growth when it went beyond, I don't know, the four or five of you or the group of consultants, and it started becoming, I don't know how to phrase, like almost like a proper business where you start having to get that structure in, and you're like, hold on, like this is getting a little bit too far to just be like a group of us now. What changed there?
So I remember, so it's funny, I remember having I have two business partners, Tevin and Mike, they're great guys, and we've been doing this together obviously since pretty much the beginning. They were some of the initial consultants that started working with me. And I remember sitting outside our office. We had a small, much smaller office at the time, in Mike's car, and having this discussion where Mike said, "But we're a real business now, and so we need to do these things."
Yeah.
So we had to start putting in place like a HR group, and we had to get like finance sorted. So there are definite sort of stages of growth, and there are growing pains that come with each of those stages. But I find that they kind of happen naturally and by necessity. You don't always plan them out. And we've gone through probably, you know, six or seven different stages of growth and change. And they're always usually quite painful, but absolutely necessary. And we're going through them still. You know, there are still things happening where, you know, just recently we sort of overhauled our technical leadership, for example. We put in place new individuals who are much more experienced at a more senior level, because we kind of needed that. We're at that point where we need to have more experienced people who are leading the technology side of things. You know, we're also now looking at HR. You know, we need to start to focus more on culture, because the company is getting larger. There are more people. So we need someone who's in charge of that, who's actually managing culture and making sure that we're still able to foster a very positive culture within our teams. And that's even more difficult with the whole sort of concept of virtual teams and virtual working.
Yeah.
So I think that we've gone through those growing pains and those changes, usually by necessity. It's on a case by case basis kind of thing. It's not something that you sit down and say, okay, in 5 years' time we're going to be doing this. You obviously have a business plan, but it doesn't always pan out that way. But I do feel that in the beginning we were sort of very opportunistic. You know, any project was good to take, you know, as long as it was going to generate revenue and it allowed us to grow. We've moved on from that. We now sort of, we're quite sort of selective in terms of which clients we want to work with. And we are much more sort of calculated, if you like, in terms of growth and how we grow, and much more strategic as well. And I just think that just comes with experience. But I also sort of think it's a lot of it is also still gut feeling and what feels right. And that's always served me well in the past. So I continue to use that too.
But things,
it's always an interesting journey when you sort of grow from 1 to 5 to 25 to 75 to 200. You know, they're very different stages and present different challenges.
What's the biggest one that you would say has changed? Because again, I've worked in organizations where it started out and there's like 5, 6, 7 of us, and then it's like you say 200, and it's a completely different ball game. And like for me, I was working, you know, reporting to someone like yourself who would be the CEO, but there was no longer, you know, where I would, you know, go out on sales meetings and things with him, like in his car and whatever. There was now just a big differential between, it just changed a lot between what my role was to his role. And I guess as I progressed, that was fine, but the same wasn't the same for new people coming in at that level. So what do you think has been the biggest change for you at the top end of that, I guess?
I think I so definitely I relate to what you're saying, you know, the CEO being in the car with the sales guys, because I used to do that all the time.
Yeah.
Or, you know, flying to Europe with them to meet with potential clients and supporting them. And I do obviously still get involved in all aspects of the business, including sales.
Yeah.
But I do feel that and especially since COVID, the biggest change for me is not being able to sort of just walk around the office and chat with people, because they're not always here, right? Because everyone's virtual. I mean, we encourage people to come into the office. And so, yeah, it's become my interactions with people have become much more rationed and planned, you know?
Yeah.
So I have someone obviously who manages my calendar, and it's like, you know, well, you have to go through that person to get a half hour with Paul to talk to him about a specific thing.
Yeah.
And it might be in 3 weeks' time because there's a lot of demand, you know?
And how,
so I kind of miss that kind of ad hoc interaction with
people. I was going to say, because you seem like the sort of individual that would have like almost an open door policy and quite very approachable. But then there's only so much of that you can do. Otherwise, you'd probably just have, like, you'd never do any job. You just be kind of...
Do you know what? I would actually love it if I could just sit here with my door open all day and just meet everybody and talk. And yeah, because that's probably the part of my job that I enjoy the most is talking to people, listening to them, understanding what's happening with them. And like, is there something I can do to help? Yeah, absolutely. That's because I think being CEO is... You're kind of like the papa bear, right? You have to kind of you're the dad, and you have to look after everyone and make sure everyone is okay, and like they know where they're going. And but I enjoy that role. I enjoy nurturing people. I enjoy helping develop people and mentoring people. And so whenever we get a new employee, the first thing I say to them is, you know, welcome to the team. I'm really happy you're here. And the second thing I say is, by the way, my virtual door is always open. Message me. I'll get back to you. It may not be straight away, but I will get back to you, and you can ask me anything, because I think that that's really important. But I think as we grow further, you're right, it's going to become more and more difficult to do that. And I think I'll miss it.
Yeah, I suppose it's a necessary thing. It's just one of those things, isn't it? I guess people envisage the CEO and think, we all work for him or for her. But actually, like, as the CEO or the business leader, you often feel the other way. It's like, I work for all of these individuals that are part of my team. I need to make sure that they're happy. Exactly. And it seems that you are, kind of encompassing that. So look, I think
it's really important. I think, and you know, for us, like, people are at the center of everything. Yeah, because without the people, we can't deliver. And so it's really important that people feel that they're part of something and that they're contributing to something. And I think that here people like working here. They like the culture. They like the fact that it's very approachable, and actually people like each other and they get on with each other, and we do good stuff together. We work well together. I think that's definitely is super important, and that's why I think we've been as successful as we are, because people, they hang around. You know? I think like employee number one is still here. Nice. As his client number one, first ever client we got in Cambridge all those years ago.
Wow.
Still a client today. So people are really, really important.
Cool. I'm just at the back of my head, I'm thinking nobody likes to be a number in the big organizations, but being an employee number one, I'd probably quite like that, to say that I'm still here.
She's called Stephanie. I'm going to do a shout out to her. She's great.
Employee number one, Stephanie.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, you mentioned kind of, you know, that's certainly one of your successes, and it's clear that you're very pleased with that. A moment ago, we also talked about, you know, COVID and that accelerated certain things in the world of clinical trials.
Yeah.
How did that impact yourselves as a business? You know, has that accelerated your growth? Has it accelerated probably the headaches as well? How's it impacted yourselves as a business?
So in relation to our clients and market share, actually had a very positive impact, because obviously all of a sudden a lot of our potential clients who didn't have solutions in place had to get a solution in place, because they were confronted with things like remote inspections. So they had to have a system to be able to present the information to the inspector.
Yeah.
And even to collaborate together as a team, because all of a sudden they couldn't go into the office and start, you know, filing documents in a filing room. They needed to go digital. So we actually saw a pretty big influx of new clients during COVID, which was great. I think it also sort of got us thinking a lot more about the future and what are the sort of future functionalities that are going to be required to be able to operate in this virtual world. And it's not, you know, it's a virtual world for the clinical teams, but it's also a virtual world for the inspectors, because inspectors are still, you know, doing remote access and all of those things. So we're sort of thinking a lot more around, you know, inspection readiness tools and remote access and all of that stuff to come up with better tool sets to support that. I think the other big impact for us in terms of, you know, the pandemic was around the way that we work here at Montrium and the team. Because from one day to the next, we went from all being in an office in downtown Montreal. So we've got this beautiful, I'm sitting here today, big office in old Montreal overlooking the river, beautiful place.
Nice.
But we went from, you know, having a full office and we were about to get a second floor in our building to having nobody here for two years. And the same in Brussels. We also have an office in Brussels and same thing, like nobody could go into the office. You weren't allowed to move around, right? There was curfew and stuff. And so, so that was quite challenging initially because we weren't used to, for example, just doing video. Like at the time, I don't know if you remember, if you did like a Zoom, you'd never put your video. It's only your voice, right? Do you remember that? Nobody really put
video. You know, I didn't even use Zoom at that point. I was kind of, I would either go and meet people in person or it would be a phone call. Like I was never on video.
Yeah, exactly. And so, so that kind of, you had to kind of adapt in the way that you were working, because all of a sudden you couldn't just sort of go and see someone and sit down next to them and have a chat and discuss something and work something out. You kind of had to schedule a web meeting. And then, you know, it's important to see people when you communicate. It's not just about words, right? It's also the way that you express yourself. It's about your hands, you know, so you need to see people. And so I think that, you know, getting that culture where, you know, you'd start to have to kind of almost force people to put their video on was tough as well. And also just the whole scheduling aspect of it as well. But the team, it actually made them more efficient and more effective being remote, which is surprising, but it's true.
It's a nice perk as a business owner sometimes, though. I think that's what we realized, because I think I was a little bit wary about it, but actually I was just like, you know what, I've hired people because I know them, I like them, I trust them, so it's just one of those things. It's that fear of letting go, it was for me anyway, but then once I done it, I was just like, I don't think I'd go back.
And I don't, and nobody wants to go back. I mean, we've asked people, you know, so do you want to come back to the office? Like, no way. And I think actually, if we force them back, they probably leave, you know, even though they like their jobs. So, no, I think that we now have a good sort of setup. We have the right tools in place so that everyone can collaborate together. We're used to working remotely. You know, it's just part of our routine now, right? We get up, you know, we do whatever we need to do, and then we log on, you know, and that's it. And we've definitely seen a lot of, you know, a lot of improvements in terms of people just being more efficient because they don't have to take the metro to go to work and not being, you know, sort of bothered by their neighbor who's having a noisy discussion, you know, with somebody else. People can focus. And especially if you're, you know, developing software, you know, it's quite a solitary job, quite, you know, if you're coding on a computer. So you don't necessarily need to be with a whole bunch of people all day, you know.
Yeah.
Do your work. And but I do feel though that, you know, the social side does suffer, and so we definitely are encouraging people now to come back, you know, 1 or 2 days a week, you know, sort of organize your week where, you know, you know you're going to have to meet people, that try and have face-to-face meetings because it's so much more effective. And also for, you know, just feeling part of things, it's important, you know.
Yeah,
it's important to meet up and connect. So so I make it my business to be here at least, you know, 2 or 3 days a week.
Nice.
And people are coming back, you know, and I'm happy to see them, and my door is still open.
There you go. Maybe that's my office,
and they come and have a cup of tea and the chat, and it's fantastic, you know.
So. Awesome. Well, I guess through this journey, it sounds like COVID had a silver lining for many businesses. It sounds like yours is right. one of them. But I know that you now run. I think you've got your own podcast. You've got your own conference. I'd love to know about some of the other big notable successes that you have had as a business. Because to go from almost like an independent consultant to growing it out to now having your own podcast, having your own conference that is one of the biggest conferences for ETMF is impressive stuff. Like, there's not many people that could boast that sort of achievement.
Right.
What has been the one that's stood out for yourself? Is there any others that I've missed, Paul?
I think that we've, one of the things that definitely we've done a good job at is our reputation. We have a pretty good reputation in the industry, and we're very much known for thought leadership.
Mm.
And the conference and the podcast is all part of that.
Yeah.
And I think that comes from having a team of, a leadership team that's very smart and switched on and motivated to do these things. Everybody here is like super motivated. And that kind of shows through. So amazing. It's not super, super tangible, but.
Tell me a bit more about the conference, because I think this year is my first real awareness of it. But I think I've perhaps been sat in the dark a little bit, because when I Google anything ETMF these days, I can't avoid you. Certainly I can't avoid much of it, which is a fantastic
thing. That's good. That's good.
You guys, right? tell us about the conference. Where did that idea come from? How long has it been running? How many, people do you have attending that?
The conference, it was actually COVID that spurred that, because we used to go to a whole bunch of conferences every year, quite often it was kind of the same content, just regurgitated over and over again, but you kind of had to go there because you had to show your face, and so when COVID hit, all of the conferences all of a sudden just got cancelled, or they went virtual.
Mm.
And the virtual ones weren't that great. They weren't super well organized, and they still were pretty expensive, And so we said, well, why don't we just do our own conference? Let's make it very democratic. Let's invite a whole bunch of people to speak.
Mm.
We're not going to charge for it, because part of who we are is about sharing our knowledge, educating people.
Wow.
And so we decided that we would set it up, and we wanted it to be different. So we wanted it to be different from all of the other conferences, where we would maybe talk about subjects that they weren't talking about. We were talking about stuff that was maybe a bit more avant-garde. And we also wanted to make it fun. We didn't want to make it super dry and boring. Mm. We started it 3 years ago. So when COVID hit.
Yeah.
And it was pretty much an overnight success. Like, there was a lot of interest. I think we had really great speaking faculties, very engaged people, quite well-known people in the industry that were willing to be part of this. The first year, I think we had around 750 people register.
Wow.
And probably about 500 showed up, which was pretty good. The next year, we decided that we would, do the same thing. It was still COVID. We still didn't have conferences. Mm. We continued on for a second year. And that year, we got around 1,600 people registered. Wow. So that was pretty big.
More than TMF. Double, treble.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And from that success, we were like, okay, well, we're going to continue this on now. There's no reason why we should stop. Mm. This year is the third year, so it's happening next month, and there's a website, tmfweek.com.
Uh-huh.
And this year again, we have like a great set of speakers. We have lots of really good panels which are very interactive and talking about the real issues that we're facing today. Mm. So things like inspection readiness and remote inspections and culture, you know, TMF culture within organizations. Super uh-huh. interesting subjects that I think a lot of people are interested in hearing about. And again, this year, you know, I think we're going to go past the 2000 mark, which is huge. Incredible. For such a niche environment. And, you know, our core values are the same. So, you know, let's keep it free. You know, let's not charge for it. I don't think we need to charge for it. You know, let's make sure we're giving back to the industry by setting up, you know, really good sessions with really good speakers. Let's make it different from all of the other conferences that are just doing the same thing.
Yeah.
And let's make it fun. And it is fun. So wow. if you've not registered, this is me plugging the conference. Go register.
Get registered. Over 2,000 people now. Well, I mean, that alone, like, if you like look out into your office and you think, look, I'm going to try and pack this place with 2,000 people that are interested. That's huge. What we're doing, like, that's a massive, massive amount of people, isn't it? So that must feel incredible. Well, it sounds like, I mean, your values shine through, certainly from yourself. But I always say when I'm recruiting for kind of our clients as CEOs, biotechs, our clients will be similar to yours. I normally look at the people at the top as to know what the culture's like. And it's, you know, it's good that you're talking about that, because it really does, you know, waterfall down and cascade down. So you've highlighted that the conference is coming up shortly. We'll make sure that we get that tagged here. In terms of future plans for yourself, it sounds like you there's a couple of plans perhaps to expand your offering as a business. Getting the sense of that? Are you able to expand on that and give us any insight?
So a lot of the clients that we work with are kind of the, you know, smaller biotechs, some mid-sized, but mainly smaller biotechs that require a lot of help, you know, in getting things up and running. So it kind of goes back to my original sort of recipe when I first started. And so what we've decided to do is also put in place a new service offering that's kind of complementary to our platform, which is kind of it's like service as a service, if you like.
Right.
Where you choose what you need on a monthly basis. So it's a recurring thing. And so we're providing things like TMF oversight, health checks, inspection readiness, mock inspections. But we're also working a lot on AI to develop AI empowered services around things like, you know, indexing and basic QC and all of these kind of very laborious manual jobs that teams do today. So trying to sort of leverage technology whilst also having a, you know, group of experts who can manage that technology and manage the service. Nice. So that's something that we're launching. We've already launched part of it. We've also launched a new education offering around TMF maturity, where we're actively providing education and workshops to our clients to really, you know, improve their knowledge around the subject and make them even more prepared for inspections. So that's something that we're doing. And then we're also actively building our next generation of platform, which is based on very modern technologies with a focus of being much more interoperable, and also focusing a lot more on sort of clinical intelligence. So trying to unlock all of this information that we have within our trial master file, which for the most part is in documents today. So trying to sort of extract that information and then providing analytics tools on top of it to be able to evaluate that information for things like compliance, or evaluating it for you know, completeness, or, you know, does it tell an accurate story? So running you know, a whole sort of bunch of different checks on that information as well. And then organizing that information in a much better way so that you can actually navigate through it very easily and understand exactly what's happened in the clinical trial. Because today, nobody really does that well. And so that's really a key focus of ours. And so we're looking to sort of come out with almost new classes of solutions. So inspection readiness tools. Nobody really sells inspection readiness tools today. But I think there's a real need for it. So we want to sort of bring out an offering around that. We also want to have a much more integrated offering as well. So today we have three key components in our system. So we have electronic trial master file, we have a quality management system, and we have a RegDocs system for the management of regulatory submission documents. All three of those things really need to be integrated. So in our quality system, we need to say what we're going to do in the study with our SOPs. We need to then integrate that into the trial master file, because the trial master file ultimately has all of the evidence to show that we followed our SOPs. And then when there are issues that occur in the study, we need to feed back into the quality system. So we're trying to sort of create a much more integrated operational system for the management of clinical trials in general. Wow. So that's kind of the direction that we're going in. And this aligns very nicely with all of the other sort of external industry initiatives like digital data flow or digital protocols, where, you know, we're going to be able to leverage those standards to actually improve our ability to pull information from all of the other systems, because we need that information to be able to tell the story, but also to provide information to the other systems as well in terms of what's going on in the clinical trial. So I think definitely we have some pretty ambitious plans, but we also have the right team of people to execute on those plans. So that's kind of where we're at now. So,
yeah, it seems like there's a lot bubbling away in the background there, and
there is.
There's probably going to be less and less time in that diary of yours by the sounds of it.
True, but you know, I'm very good at delegating too. So I say, this is what I want. Produce it. So yeah,
awesome. Well, I guess that's why you surround yourself with good people, right? So
exactly.
Very, very good stuff. But look, Paul, we always close the show with a quick fire questions round. So before I let you get off, I'll fire a couple of these at you. And I guess, look, the first one I ask everyone is, you know, if there was one piece of advice that you could give to your younger self, what would that perhaps be?
Recognize your strengths and be more confident.
Okay. Like it. Yeah. And in terms of books, resources, anything like that, is there anything, or what's the number one resource, I guess, that you would perhaps recommend for our audience? Doesn't need to be clinical research related, could be something that you enjoy outside of work, but yeah, what would be the number one resource?
So there's one book that I refer to a lot. This is more for people that are maybe starting a business or running a business. It doesn't need to be a clinical research business. And it's a book called Crossing the Chasm. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but
I've
it's
not
really
heard of it, but I always take a note of these books because
Crossing the Chasm. So very good book. I need to look up the author, but it's a book that really helped me sort of build my business and understand the dynamics of going through those sort of growth spurts. Crossing the Chasm.
Okay, well, I always look these up myself. I mean, this is one of my gold mines for information, is this podcast and asking about that. And look, I guess speaking of building a business, it sounds like to start with, you were, you know, very much working with people that you knew and had, you know, experiences with. But as things have expanded, you know, it's very clear that you are keen on culture. What are the three qualities that you value most when trying to put together your teams? What are those? Yeah, what are the company values when it comes to culture?
So for me, I want people that are good at building, you know, sort of trust. Trust is really important in all sort of aspects of what we do. Trust with our clients, you know, trust with our employees. So trust is a really important value. Quality. Like, I really want people that are passionate about building a quality product or providing a quality service. I think that's super important. And then I think also happiness. I think that happiness is super important. And we have rules in our organization. So we like rules by which we operate. And rule number one is be happy. And if you're not happy, change it. If we're bringing in new team members, we want to make sure that they're going to be happy and that they're a good fit. And so
I like it,
making sure that people connect are going to be happy. That's really important.
Awesome stuff. And I think my next question is about what you get up to outside of work. As I say, look, sometimes there's this persona of big bad CEOs, but right. I've often found that that is far, far, far from the case for everyone that I deal with. It's really true. Normally, the higher up you go, the nicer the individuals are. But look, what do you do to relax, Paul, when you're not grinding away with, you know, getting issues sorted?
So I do quite a few things, but one thing that I really like doing is I like woodworking. So I actually bought a cottage in the Laurentian Mountains just north of Montreal about 8 years ago, and it was you know, an old cottage on a small lake. It's kind of falling apart, but it had a really beautiful, like, you know, garden and beautiful vista in the mountains.
Yeah,
and that's where I discovered that I actually like working wood. And so, you know, just repairing the house, like building stuff with wood was really and it's something that was really creative, but didn't require you to sort of think like you would think for when you're sort of developing software. You know, it's something completely different. So it allowed you to kind of relax, you know. So no, I definitely maybe I should have been a carpenter. But I decided to do this instead. So I definitely have like a creative side. And then the other thing I do a lot is I actually cook a lot as well. So in a previous life, I worked a lot in kitchens and stuff when I was very young, and always was very involved in cooking. And so I definitely enjoy cooking for my friends and enjoying the good things in life.
Amazing stuff. Well, we'll wrap things up there, Paul. For anyone that wants to reach out to you, learn more, I know that there is the Montreal website, and I'm assuming that there's going to be a link on there for TMF Week. If not, we'll also get that tagged as part of the show. But is there any other way that, you know, people should be, you know, if they want to learn more about Montreal, what's the best place?
Yeah, I mean, so obviously the website, and we're about to launch a brand new website, in fact, so there'll be even more information, but that's definitely your first port of call. But we're also very active on LinkedIn and the social network, so interact with us. And, you know, I think our team is very sort of outward facing. So social media is definitely a good way of contacting us. And if you have anything you want to talk about, our door is always open as well. So.
Amazing.
Feel free to reach out to me as well.
Good man. Well, Paul, look, thanks very much for joining me on the show. Been an absolute pleasure.